I'm sure you're in a very jovial mood this morning, and you're not uptight like yesterday, and I'm sure that this morning we are going to have a very interesting meeting with the ELRC. When it comes to the ELRC, I think at the beginning of the meeting, because I believe you are acting, yes, you'll have to say, you know, why, what happened to the acting chairperson, was your CEO of ELRC, that we know exactly, and that could be recorded. And I don't think this meeting will be too long today. I'm sure we'll be out by 12, or past 12. Because we're only having you here this morning, and we're not having our other entities. You know, that the engagement that we're going to have with you will go very well like yesterday. And I'd like to welcome you to the meeting, and the same to the honorable members. Thank you. Llewellyn, is there any apologies today?
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, sir. We've received an apology from Honorable Gina, who won't be able to make it for the meeting for prior to the meeting.
Thanks a lot, Llewellyn. And I think that is for your information too, Honorable Bonshana. Thank you. Didn't you hear the apology? No, Honorable Gina? Yes, just since you won't be at the meeting today. just have it noted, but not what he's saying. Just have the apology noted. Thank you. I'm handing over to the ELRC.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. My name is Jeff Mushah. I am the Chief Financial Officer of the Education Labor Relations Council. However, I will be wearing another hat today, that of the Accounting Officer. I am the Acting General Secretary of the Education Labor Relations Council. The General Secretary left the Education Labor Relations Council at the end of June 2012. However, he's not lost to the public service. He's moved on to the Department of Public Works. So that's where he is located. And we are carrying on, and I would also like to introduce my team who are here with me, starting from Cindy Foka. Cindy is the senior manager looking after the collective bargaining services of the Education Labor Relations Council. And she will also be assisting me today with the presentation. She will cover her area of specialization, if I may term it. And next to Cindy, we have, it's also a familiar face. We brought her last year, Grace Niewat, a colleague of ours who is the provincial manager of our provincial chamber, of the Western Cape Provincial Chamber. She is based in Belleville, Cape Town. And any issues relating to provincial issues, she will assist in throwing some light on how things are really done at the provincial level. Thank you. I think I've covered all the introductions that I wanted to do. Now, going back to the presentation, it's going to be over a couple of sections. The first one, let's look at the table of contents. The introduction, which I've already started, I'll continue with it because there are some few things that I would like to cover in terms of the introduction. And coming to the compliance report, I think we'll cover also legislative requirements in terms of our operational compliance with the legislative requirements. And then getting to Section B, the performance reports, our core businesses, dispute resolution and collective bargaining. I will cover the dispute management services, and Cindy will go through the collective bargaining services and also including the executive services. And I will do the annual financial statements as the chief financial officer, and I will also conclude the presentation. Now, in terms of the introduction, let's look at where our mandate comes from. The ELRC mandate comes from the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, comes also from the legislation, and also from the applicable laws, regulations, and conventions. The constitutional mandate really where we want to draw the attention is Section 23 of the Constitution, Bill of Rights, which cover the areas where everyone has the right to fair labor practices. Section 28.2 is a child's best interest is of paramount importance in matters relating to children. And Section 29.1, I think that one covers the right to strike. Sorry, not the right to strike, the right to education. Those are the three key mandates that we closely adhere to in our operations, specifically in the sections relating to dispute resolution, because we have cases where children are involved in the process of dispute resolution, and therefore we need to ensure that those interests are really taken into considerations in terms of how the processes go, including even the venues where those processes should take place where a child is involved. Now, the other mandates in terms of the Labor Relations Act, Section 28, I think that's where it deals with the powers and the functions of a bargaining council. The Labor Relations Act specifically in that we draw our mandate. And Section 51, which deals with the dispute resolution functions of a bargaining council. And Section 64 to 69 really deals with strikes and lockouts. And the other mandate, as normal, being a public entity within the education sector, the service delivery agreement of the Minister of Basic Education as the accounting authority of the Education Labor Relations Council. And that tied to that, there is also an action plan to 2014. And when it comes to our strategic plans, annual performance plans, we need to ensure that we do contribute towards the achievement of outcome number one. Now, the next area to cover would be the normal vision and mission, just to emphasize where we are to improve the quality of teaching and learning through labor peace. And our mission is quality services for excellence in teaching. Now, also the organizational values, professionalism, transparency, independence. If we go to the next page, then we look at accountability, fairness and equity, relating specifically there to the adjudication of grievances and disputes. If you look at efficiency, delivery of quality services economically, wherever possible, we do try to measure ourselves in terms of quality standards, specifically relating to the efficiency thereof. we do adapt to the organizational values of as inscribed in the presentation. Now, the next one would be just a preamble to indicate our fulfillment of our mandate to promote and maintain labor peace in public education. We further continue to offer support to teachers living with and affected by HIV/AIDS through the PCTA project, which unfortunately has come to an end over the initial contracted period of 5 years. We have also forged closer collaborations with our accounting authority, which is the Department of Basic Education, in a bid to contribute towards the attainment of Outcome 1 of the Schooling 2025 initiative. Now, when it comes to compliance, the report, we would be looking at the applicable legislation. Now, in this case, it will be legislation covering our operations, unlike the mandate, which really it gives you the framework within which you can operate and not go outside the framework. But here, in terms of carrying out our operations, we are again the Labor Relations Act, the National Education Policy Act. If you look at the Labor Relations Act as an example where we do our operations in terms of reporting, we need to ensure that Section 53 of the Labor Relations Act is adhered to. And in the 2011-2012 financial annual report, which we also submit to the Registrar of Labor, there has been a concern raised in terms of how we had reported, because in terms of Section 53 of the Labor Relations Act, we need to indicate in our report as to whether proper books of accounts were kept and whether the solvency is still applicable. However, I think it's an issue that we have taken up with the Auditor General, whereby it has been resolved that the reporting of the public entity in this case, which is a Schedule 3A registered, would normally differ with those other bargaining councils where there is no other framework in terms of reporting. In the public entity, the reporting is within the framework of the Public Finance Management Act and also generally recognized accounting practice. Now, the Promotion of Access to Information Act in all our operations, we need to ensure that we comply. The Employment of Educators Act, we have to ensure that we only deal with educators who are employed in terms of the Employment of Educators Act. Those educators who are not employed in terms of the Employment of Educators Act, we don't really have jurisdiction over the disputes that they might refer to the Education Labor Relations Council. The last one really deals with further education, FETC colleges. I know it's not really the area that we are here for. However, as a public entity, in our report, we need to ensure that we report in all the operations. The FETC Act has made that the ELRC should have a bargaining unit. We call it a bargaining unit, which specifically looks at the interests of those employed in the further education and training colleges. So there is a separate bargaining council. However, even though they would now be in the higher education and training department, they are still, as the ELRC, have a bargaining unit there because they don't fall anywhere else except there. Now, those are the key legislation which directs the ELRC in our core businesses of dispute resolution and collective bargaining. Now, if you go to the next, we look at the other thing is litigation and appeals, which during the period under review, there has been an increase. And are quite not sure. We haven't really pinned what that increase might be coming from, what the cause of that. However, we think it's because more of the educators really recognize and know that they have the right to appeal if they're not satisfied with any outcome relating to a dispute which has been processed through the Education Labor Relations Council. However, as the ALRC, as a matter of course, we do not oppose those applications for review of the awards at the Labor Court. Now, I think that would conclude the compliance section of the Education Labor Relations Council. Now, in terms of the accounting officer's report, briefly what we would like to highlight is when we look at the review of the operations, we are glad to report that it reveals no concerns in terms of the sustainability of the Education Labor Relations Council in terms of its solvency. The annual financial statements are prepared on an ongoing basis. That is, we will be around for the foreseeable future as a bargaining council and also as a public entity. In terms of the events that might have happened subsequent to the end of the financial period, there were no material events really that would affect the results of the operations that we are reporting on to the Portfolio Committee today. Interest in contracts, during the period under review, we never had any contracts really involving the accounting authority where there were no contracts which were entered into. Now, the approval of the report, in terms of the constitution of the Education Labor Relations Council, we need to have an annual general meeting where the annual report must be approved. So I'm glad to report that within the period in terms of the constitution, the annual general meeting of the ELRC was held in August where the annual report was approved. Now, the next one is just to also look at what really composes the bargaining council. The employer, this is representing the state as the employer. It is the collective, which is made up of the provincial departments of education, coordinated by the Department of Education, which is the Department of Basic Education and the Department of Higher Education and Training, because it relates to that FETC Act that I referred to earlier. Now, in terms of the employee side of the composition, there are trade unions. CTU stands for Combined Trade Union. So in terms of Combined Trade Union SATU, that is made up of SATU, the South African Democratic Teachers Union, and also the Cape Teachers Professional Association, which is mostly based in the Western Cape. So they act together in all negotiations when they come to council. And then the other part is the Combined Trade Union, ATU, which is made up of a number of trade unions. The first one is the National Professional Teachers Organization of South Africa, which is NAPTOSA, SAOU, as the South African Honorary Racers INI. NATU is the National Teachers Union, PEU is the Professional Educators Union, and then there's also the PSA, Public Service Association, and the last smaller one is HOSPESA. So those are the two major combined trade unions which are under the combined trade union arrangement within the Education Labor Relations Council. Now, the next section, we will look now then at the core businesses performance for the year under review. I will be doing the dispute resolution section, and thereafter I'll hand over to my colleague here, Cindy, as I indicated before. She will take us through the collective bargaining cases during the period under review. Now, in terms of the dispute resolution services, we will look at the referrals, we will look at the nature of those disputes, and we will also look at the outcomes. And lastly, we will also touch on how we intend to prevent those disputes before happening, because I think that's the only way you can reduce the number of the referrals of the disputes to the council. Now, in terms of the referrals by year, I think we've provided a graph since the 2003-2004 financial year, where there was a trend of a reduction in the number of disputes which have been referred up to the 2006-2007 financial year. However, in the 2007 and 2008 financial year, there was a big jump to 955. And fortunately, we know what that variance comes from. And that was the year where we had the public servants strike. So really, we had a number of disputes referred, and the majority of them were relating to the strike deductions. Now, and then the following year we came down and we went up, and now unfortunately in the 2011-2012 report that we're looking at, there has been a jump in almost in all provinces. We'll indicate in the other following slides where basically there hasn't been any decrease except one province where there has been a decrease, but all other areas, nine of them, that is including national, there has been an increase. Now, if you go to the next slide, we look at the 741 that we indicated in the graph. As compared to the previous financial year, we had 210 more referrals. Now, the increase was experienced despite the relations between the employer and the employee being relatively stable in the past year. And we still are not sure really what the cause might be. However, we have a feeling that I think more and more of our educators also start realizing their rights, and they exercise those rights, and wherever they don't feel satisfied, they would refer, you know, anything they're not satisfied with to the Education and Labor Relations Council. However, also I think there's also an increasing trust on the ELRC processes, whereby we tend to think that might be the cause of the increases. If we then go to the next slide, we look at the jurisdiction of the referrals that we've received. Now, of the 741 that I showed in the previous slides, 179 of those referrals were determined to be out of jurisdiction at initial screening. So the positive side is they're becoming less, and that's a positive sign in terms of understanding when and how referrals need to be determined. When we report in terms of referrals, even though a referral may be out of jurisdiction, in terms of legislative requirement, we need to register it and report on it. And thereafter, we do the initial screening and saying we don't have jurisdiction on this, and then we don't look at it. And if you take now the 741 and 179 referrals which were out of jurisdiction, you end up really with 580 referrals that we had to deal with. Now, with the continuous engagement with the dispute practitioners, we do that to aim to reduce this number further. I think what we're doing is we're empowering and also educating the dispute resolution practitioners, both on the employer and also on the employee side, on how really we should be, because most of the referrals, they would be done through the unions. Unions who would be putting in the referrals on behalf of their members. So what we're doing is we're doing an education to dispute resolution practitioners in both employer and employee, and we aim to reduce this number further. So we also indicate that the out-of-jurisdiction disputes signify the discontentment that should be addressed at provincial level, because basically all our educators are are employed at the provincial level. They're all employees of the provincial departments of education. So there are provincial dispute prevention task teams, and that's what we are really targeting, to say, let's go at the cause before it becomes a referral. That is, we look at now the grievances and try to resolve the issues at that level before they become disputes. Now, if you go to the next slide, I think that's the one that I said, you know, if you look at the referrals by province, what comes up there is the highest referring province is the Western Cape. But if you look at the number of educators in provinces, the highest number you find is KZN, followed by the Eastern Cape. And the Western Cape is way below. I think it comes in at number 6. But the number of referrals is very, very high. If you look at the Eastern Cape, it's 94. If you look at the Western Cape, it's 176. And that's what we also would like to try and find out. What is it that makes smaller provinces in terms of numbers have a higher referral rate as compared to other provinces with a high number of educators, but the referrals are not comparable with those of smaller provinces. Now, if you look at the Free State, Grace, can you just quickly go back there? If you look at the Free State is the only province where we had a decrease in the number of referrals. And now if you look at the Free State, then you start asking yourself, what is it that makes educators in the Free State not really refer disputes to the ELRC? Because there has been an increase. Despite that, overall there has been an increase. And what we are doing is we are now zooming into the Free State and see if we can learn something that they are doing which we can apply in other provinces in order to reduce the number of disputes which are being referred. Thanks, Grace. Now, the Western Cape, I think I've already spoken on that, is the highest referring province at 176, followed by the KZN. Now, the Mpumalanga, that's MP, is the least referring province, and it alternates with the Northern Cape. And I think with the Northern Cape, you can understand that the Northern Cape, although it's the biggest province, it's got the smallest number of educators because of the population of that province. However, but you look at Mpumalanga, you look at the Western Cape, Mpumalanga is the least referring, but you know, it's more or less it's got the same number of educators with the Western Cape, but it's also got the least number of referrals. And we look into those things and see what is it that makes the Western Cape really always refer their disputes to the council. Now, I think I've also indicated the Free State where there has been a drop in the referrals. Now, if you go to the next slide, we will be looking at now the nature of those disputes. Now, there are different types of nature. Now, you look at the promotions, there are dismissals, there are unfair labor practice, ULP, interpretation and application of collective agreements, and also the BCEA, Basic Conditions of Employment Act, which mostly will deal with interest. All along, in fact, since, I would say, the inception of the ELRC, disputes relating to promotions and appointments has always been the highest. And one of the reasons would be that normally they don't start at a grievance level. There are no grievances or there are no grievance procedures at that level when it relates to promotions and appointments. So once an educator is aggrieved in terms of promotions and appointments, they would automatically refer that to the Education Labor Relations Council. And that's an area really that we are trying to bring down, but if you look at the three-year period that we have indicated there, in 2010-2011, we did try and bring that down, but you can still see after that, you know, the period under review is gone back to 311 as compared to 2 years ago where it was 301. So that's an area that we need to try and zoom into the unions and try and see what we can do in order to reduce the number of disputes specifically relating to promotions and appointments. And then when it comes to the dismissals, it's also becoming a bit stagnant. You know, there will always be dismissals, we know, but I think we try and see how we could help and assist in terms of bringing those down. Unfair labor practice also is a concern because if you look at the trend, it's really going up. And we are zooming into those areas where consent is raised. And then the interpretation and application also, you can see, although in terms of numbers you might think it's not really going up that much, but I think, you know, from 5 to 5%, and then from 5%, it just zooms to 8.3%. It's also another area where we need to look into, because interpretation and application of collective agreements really is what happens where agreement has been reached in collective bargaining, and now collective agreements are supposed to be implemented at the provincial level. And then we look at the Basic Conditions of Employment Act and also the interest. Interest really is not much of a concern. You can see we started at 4% and we're now at less than a percent. And in the previous financial year, we really did not have any dispute in relation to interest. The following slide will indicate the nature in detail, I think, where promotions, enforcement of the basic conditions of employment and interpretation are standing at 53%, do not require a grievance procedure. I think I've also referred to that on the presentation of that graphic in the previous slide. And I think, you know, because of that, we find that at that level of 53% is somewhere where we need to zoom in and try and see how we can reduce that. And then 29 of the 196 dismissals involved learners as victims. So that number, again, is one where I refer to in terms of the sections of the Bill of Rights, where I say it's where we need to ensure that the interest of children, either as victims or as witnesses, needs to be closely looked after. And what we do in terms of those type of processes is we have embarked now on the training of what we call intermediaries, because they are required to intermediate when the disputes are involved children as victims. And also the venue, in terms of the venue, they are not held at the normal venue that we will hold our dispute processes. And what we really use is in conjunction with the Department of Justice at the court levels, we use wherever possible what they call children's courts, where we know at least the infrastructure is there. And in the Gauteng province, we use the Teddy Bear Clinic with the assistance of the Gauteng Provincial Department, where they have identified that and they assist in arranging that as a venue for the disputes involving children. Now, the interpretation and enforcement of disputes are showing a steady rise, and I think I've referred to that. They warrant some attention from us. Now, the nature of disputes by province. I think, again, if you look at the nature by province, KZN in terms of promotions and appointments, you can see is the highest at 94. And the lowest will always be, we would expect it to be Northern Cape. But if you look at the Free State, you know, it's even less than what is happening in the Northern Cape. So that's also an indication that we could maybe learn something from the Free State province in order to see what is it that they're doing right at the provincial level that we could also replicate or apply in other provinces. Those are really statistics coming back to that number of 744 in terms of referrals. So the analysis here is done on those that have been referred. We don't really take out those which are out of jurisdiction. Now we go to the next slide where we say, okay, there are processes that we go through. There are processes that we conduct in terms of resolving disputes. Now the processes are conciliation and arbitration. Now, in terms of the 2010-2011 compared to 2011-2012, there has been, in fact, an increase in both conciliation, which is the darker blue, and even arbitration, which is the other one. Now, this is a positive sign in that once you increase the processes that you conduct, it means your disputes are resolved more quickly, and you can ensure that not much time is spent out of the classroom by educators, and more time is spent on the processes. So we are working towards again looking at a decrease in terms of the time taken, but that will mean then you need to increase the processes. However, there are constraints that we realize we work within. The panelists, or what you may call the commissioners, who really go chair all these proceedings, are not really full-time employees of the DLRC. They are all outsourced. They are part-time, and they are not only working for the ELRC. They also work for other bargaining councils. Some of them also work for the CCMA. So it will depend on the dates available from those panelists to be able to take our cases on those days. And also, there's also constraints in terms of the dispute resolution practitioners on the side of the employer, whereby, for instance, if you look at KZN, they wouldn't have officials who need to attend in all areas that we would like to have. If you have a process taking place in Newcastle, and another process must take place in Empangeni, another one must be taking place in Port Shepstone. Sometimes the capacity from the employer is not able to cover all those areas all at the same time. So there are those constraints. And what we're trying to do is to train more of the dispute resolution practitioners from the employer side so that we capacitate them so that they could be able to have more available for dates that are applicable for those cities. Now, the next slide will indicate what really I have talked about, but it goes further than when we talk about the 503 conciliation processes were conducted out of the 500 cases involved. What it really means is at conciliation level, you expect that if you have 508 cases, there should be 508 processes, because if at conciliation, at the first sitting of conciliation, nothing is resolved, then a certificate must be issued. So that is an indication that somehow there were about five processes which set more than once. And that is not normal for conciliation to do. However, sometimes with the agreement of both parties, they would come to the end of that day and parties still feel there is chance for conciliation. Why can't we just extend it for a day and then we can conciliate? Because I think it's always better to resolve at conciliation than at arbitration, because as you all know, arbitration is binding rather than at conciliation. So there was a slight difference between the two processes. And if you look at the processes relating to arbitration, there were 707 cases involved in terms of arbitration, but the processes were 766. We do expect that at arbitration, because of the involvement of legal practitioners, because of the involvement of witnesses, so it tends to draw out. If you have to accommodate five witnesses, you cannot sit once. So the process will definitely be more than what the case is involved. So that's what we're really showing in terms of that. Now, the last slide in terms of the processes, which is the outcomes. I think if you look at the graph, we are showing withdrawal at conciliation. We are showing withdrawal at arbitration. Well, it happens to be 43 in both. And then the second one, starting from the right, is dismissal at conciliation and dismissal at arbitration. And the last one is when we say how many were settled at conciliation and how many were settled at arbitration. And then the last one, which is the 168, really relates to the awards, because we don't consider awards as settlement. When we calculate our settlement rate, we exclude awards, because that's a different process related to arbitration. Then the last one, I think, it's not the last one. I think it's more of narrating to the slide that I had before. We indicate that the 280 disputes which were settled in the past financial year, they fall far short of what the norm is of the CCMA target. If you look at the 18% that we're talking about and you look at the 70% for the CCMA, the difference mostly is because the CCMA deals with disputes in the private sector. And we deal with disputes in the public sector. And the main difference is we deal with parties who needs to settle or agree based on mandates. So they need, even if sometimes we sit and go through the dispute, sometimes or most of the times, they need to seek mandates from their principals. So that is why the settlement rate there, if you look at it, is 18%. And that's really the reason why you will never ever compare the settlement rate in the public sector with the settlement rate in the private sector. In the private sector, I think the time that the private sector would spend at the CCMA, most of the time at conciliation, they would prefer to settle. And most of the time also, because we talk about people who have profits, they can even pay out at the settlement rate rather than having to waste time and money if they go forward into arbitration. However, with the ELRC, we don't have the luxury of saying we do have funds. We have limited funds. We are constrained by funds. And we have to go through the whole process of conciliation on top of the mandates that the parties need to seek. Now, the last one is the 168 arbitration awards were rendered, and 29 of these involved a child as a victim. So we do have arbitration awards. More and more, in fact, there's an increase relating to cases involving the child as a victim. When we go to the next slide, Grace, we go to the last part, dispute prevention. And the way we approach, I referred earlier on to dispute prevention task teams. We are trying to work with the provinces, specifically the labor relations directorates at that level, where we would like to see and assist in reducing the number of grievances or settling grievances at that level before they become disputes. However, we need to also ensure that we must maintain our impartiality, in that we must not be seen to be working with the employer and not with the employees. And most of the task teams at that level, the prevention task teams, we also involve both parties, the employer and the employee, to be part of those teams, whereby we look at those grievances. And we started in the new financial year, and what statistics are showing us is we still have a lot to do in terms of other provinces. If you look at the grievances relating to KwaZulu-Natal, there were 56, and, you know, 54 were finalized, and only 2 were not finalized. And I think the achievement rate is very, very high. And that's an indication where we would like to see what we can learn in other provinces to ensure that we apply it also in other provinces in terms of the prevention of dispute by zooming in at the grievances level. Now, the next slide will continue, in fact, to what I have indicated on the processes involved. The information that we gather from the dispute prevention task teams at the provincial level, we are sure that it will enable us to make the necessary interventions. And also the submission by the provinces of the statistics, although it's still a work in progress, it has started to show some trends which are very positive and which can be applicable in other provinces. The last one relating to dispute resolution relates to professional development and training. And this relates to both the dispute resolution practitioners and also our panelists, or you might call them the commissioners, where we continuously update them on recent developments relating to dispute resolution, relating to any feedback that we get in terms of awards that have been reviewed at the Labor Court, and also case law pronounced at the Labor Court relating to resolution of disputes. And we do it both for the employer. As you can see, the first one there, we have 8 employer representatives that we are putting through the program. And then there's also practical law, which we have done for the CTU Combined Trade Union, ATU, and also the case management, the capacity building training, mostly also for the dispute resolution practitioners. And then we also had a case management specifically for the NATO representatives, and the annual training and developmental workshop for dispute practitioners and panelists. We will see when we come to the allocation of funding to this process, to this operations that we do, specifically in terms of training. We're talking there about over 3 million that is spent or that is allocated in terms of professional development and training of both dispute resolution practitioners and commissioners, so panelists. And I think I might have come to the end of the presentation relating to dispute resolution services. And I will hand over, Chair, to my colleague, Cindy Forter, and she will take us through the achievements of what happened during the 2011-2012 in relation to collective bargaining services, both at national level and also at provincial level. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Mashaka. And I'll hand over to you, Cindy. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, and the Honourable Member. For a bit there, I was quite scared when the CFO referred to the achievements. So when I looked at the presentation itself, it does not talk much to the achievements, except to highlight that there is currently a concern in terms of performance with regard to collective bargaining. However, we also wish to report to the members that the observation has been made by the governance structure of council, which is the executive committee, and to such they have agreed that they need to convene an ex-co reporter, which will extend, the invitation will be extended to the principals of ELRC. Therefore, it will not only be the negotiators, but also the principals who are in the main, the decision makers in terms of giving mandates. And further to that, the invitation will also be extended to the provinces, because there, while the report will show that there has been significant improvement, but if you look at the report that has been presented earlier on, there are still areas that the LRC has zoomed in, which we feel that a lot can be improved in terms of the disputes, the nature of the disputes, as well as the number of disputes referred. So in short, Chairperson, that is simple to say that performance in terms of collective bargaining, we don't have much that we can pride ourselves in, because much of the time was dedicated in work of the task teams, which of course, if we all of us understand that once the testing is prepared to the work, then that is subjected to the actual collective bargaining, which is influenced by the mandate-seeking processes, which in the main we can attribute this poor performance to that mandate-seeking processes, because some parties, they come back after the work has been done, they come back and say, no, we have since revised our position, we want the whole matter to be opened up for discussion again, which then means you don't have a product to go out and say, out of that work, this is a collective agreement that we feel we can create an impact out there in terms of improving education at large. Then we only concluded 3 collective agreements for the year under review, but however, I also need to highlight there as well that performance is not necessarily measured in terms of the number of agreements concluded, but we are measured in terms of the predetermined objectives that were set out. So this is just to highlight that, notwithstanding the fact that we're saying that there was poor performance, there were areas wherein parties concluded agreements at a national level. Then, Chair, I'll move to the provinces. If honorable members and Chairperson, you'd recall that last year when we presented our report, it was not a very nice picture when it comes to provinces. And as such, one honorable member came with a proposal that FDLRC should consider closing down the provincial chambers. But we are proud this year to announce that we've seen a significant improvement in terms of performance at the chambers, again, in terms of the predetermined objectives, with the exception being 2 provinces, which is Eastern Cape and KZN. I'll elaborate more on the next slide in terms of those 2 provinces. And again, there we have done an assessment in terms of the overall performance. You can see that we're highlighting that 5 provinces have performed over 80%, whilst others are 73 and 1 is 60, which is quite an improvement in terms of what we presented last year. Then, Chair, as I alluded to earlier on, that I'll give more details in terms of the 2 provinces where we are still showing a concern in terms of performance as per their predetermined objectives. The starting point being the Eastern Cape, I'm sure members have seen it. It featured a lot on the news over the past year, in other words, the year under review. But in the main, what we want to report to Parliament is that we had conducted facilitation in the province as a way of trying to normalize the situation, and that facilitation was informed by the MOA, which was concluded between the Premier, the MEC Education, Health, and the teacher unions. In fact, even the unions in health signed the MOU. But the ELRC got involved in so far as the areas where education was involved. Then the facilitation process took place, and then there were 2 task teams that were established, which looked mainly at the cause of the problems in the province when it comes to our non-performance in the chamber, which was the PPN for 2012, and also the issue of the temporary teachers. Chair, again, there, whilst we are showing a report that indicates that there hasn't been achievement in terms of the predetermined objectives, but again, we are proud to indicate that our work has resulted into a collective agreement in terms of the appointment of temporary teachers, which in the main was the area of dispute between the employer and the employee parties in the province. And again, we have seen to it that consultation, which is one of the areas that had led to the disengagement between the 2 parties, consultation on PPN, this year it has taken place, but that too will be shown in detail in the report of this current financial year in terms of Eastern Cape. And it is envisaged that now that the situation has normalized in terms of the chamber activities, we will then be able to go back to the predetermined objectives and then try to get the chamber to work towards achieving those objectives. Then, Chairperson, in terms of, and honorable members, in terms of KZN, again, in KZN, we are showing a report that is indicating that in terms of the predetermined objectives, they haven't achieved anything in terms of what we have there on the table. But however, again, there is work that has taken place there to normalize the state of education in the province, and that has been done through the supervision of the MEC. And in KZN, they focused most on the priority areas, which they had identified as the problem of un- and underqualified educators, the monitoring of the post-provisioning norms, as well as the issue of attending or addressing the problems of displaced educators. As we know, that that's the province that is unique in terms of that particular problem, where educators are displaced because of violence and intimidation that's taking place there. Then, Chair, in moving to the next slide, again, I've touched to it earlier on to indicate that in the provinces we've seen improvement in terms of their performance. We can cite a few agreements that have been concluded in two provinces. And then while citing such, quickly move to the areas that they've all, generally all provinces have been focusing on, which is consultation, information sharing, because in the main, provinces are not there for bargaining. Bargaining takes place at national. Provinces are there for implementation, consultation, and the information sharing. Therefore, they have done that, as we have indicated in our summary earlier on. Then, Chair, we move to the next session, which is dispute prevention support services. I think the report of the accounting officer highlighted that there is significant work that is being done by the unions in terms of the dispute resolution and prevention. This slide relates to the provisioning for such that there is a collective agreement wherein there's 120 number that is assigned to educators who are seconded to do full-time work for unions to assist in such instances, that is for disputes as well as for collective bargaining. And you can see they were showing a table in terms of the distribution of such. Then the next slide talk to the actual work which these individuals which are provided for, the CFO will touch on in terms of the actual expense which are provided for by the ELRC, because those individuals, their salaries are funded by the ELRC. In other words, the department will second the individual, then whoever that is appointed as a substitute for such gets to be funded through the ELRC budget. Then, Chair, moving to the executive services, I think last year we did report that apart from our core mandate, which is dispute resolution and collective bargaining, the ELRC is the previous slide, please. The ELRC is facilitating special projects, which is TLI is one of such. And we reported last year on the launches that had taken place with the hope that at that time we had envisaged the situation that the full implementation of Teacher Laptop Initiative shall have kicked in for the year that we are reporting now. But however, Chairperson, we need to report to the committee that there has been problems in terms of TLI, and we have cited problems there that in the main, the rolling out of the Teacher Laptop Initiative was hindered by the rules of the National Credit Act, wherein when profiling was done of individual educators who wanted to access the benefits, they did not meet the rules, because as we all know that there is credit that is involved in the process. Therefore, the banks were reluctant to fund the teacher laptop in terms of the individuals who wanted to access the benefit without the state guarantee. And as such, that warranted that the government had to go back and review the funding model. So the talks currently are at that level. But we are also, Chairperson, here to confirm that a report detailing what has transpired and where we are in terms of our involvement and where the problems are was handed over to the Department of Basic Education in March 2012, which is this current year. Then the second aspect of executive services talks to the mobilizing of employees, which is provisioning for human resource. So we can report there that there were 6 new appointments that were made in the period under review. And we are also showing an expense in terms of the expenditure for the human resource component of our operations. But I wouldn't talk much on that. The CFO will cover that. I think, Chair, that concludes the executive services part of the presentation.
Thank you, ma'am. And over to our acting CEO.
Thank you. I think maybe just to finalize that issue of HR before I go to the financial statements. There's an issue of employment equity, I think, which we need to ensure we comply. And I think we are 99% in compliance with the employment equity requirements. The only area where we are falling short is we have set ourselves a target of 3 employees who should be disabled, and we are short of one in that area. In terms of gender, I think we have been in compliance or even exceeding what is really required in terms of that. And we look at the vacancies also, I think that's an area that we need to highlight. There is a 26%, I would say, it's a vacancy rate. And that is being attended to at the moment. And we hope that by the end of this financial year, we really should be at where the funded, approved posts relating to provisioning of employees is. However, I need also to indicate that where vacancies exist, it's not more in the core businesses of the council. If you look at dispute resolution services, there are no vacancies relating to dispute resolution. And if you look at the collective bargaining, I think the vacancies that exist are really normal vacancies that will incur in terms of the turnover rate. And we are glad to say really the vacancies are mostly in support services, and they don't affect the provision and delivery of collective bargaining and dispute resolution services. I just thought maybe I should add on to that before I take you through the financial highlights. I think when you look at the financial highlights, I need to maybe point out that the Education Labor Relations Council received an unqualified audit report from the Auditor General. We are also proud to report that we are still liquid, we are solvent, and I have earlier indicated that we have prepared our annual financial statements on a going concern basis. That is, we'll still be around for the next foreseeable year if we put in our annual performance plans, our strategic plans, which we presented also here in March of this year. The NTF period, we know those are going to be covered through the status of solvency and liquidity which we are experiencing. Now, what is the funding model? If you go to the next page, our funding model really is levies. That's really what keeps us going. If you look at the trend compared to the previous financial year, the variance is even less than 1%. That is, if there is no growth in terms of educators, there's also no growth in terms of levies received. So the only way we could increase our income to support our operations will be through a negotiated increase in levies. However, once an increase is negotiated and agreed upon, it tends to take more than 5 years to carry the operations of the council. The last increase that we negotiated and agreed upon was in 2007. So in terms of the levies, I think it's a constraint that depends on the number of educators. The number of educators, we look at the contributors there, 114,000 in 2012, In relation to the previous year, we look at 411,850. Now, expanding on the next slide is the performance in terms of the income received. Our total income, 49,450,000. You look at the previous year, also 49,422. Definitely what I referred in the previous slide. Now, the total expenditure of 47,938 as compared to the previous year. I think you would see there's a decrease in terms of total expenditure. And that decrease was mostly because the projects that my colleague Cindy referred to, some of them were really winding down, like the teacher laptop initiative that she referred to. Those were really winded down over the years. Now, in the previous year, you look at the operations surpluses. Unfortunately, in the previous year, we had a deficit. However, that deficit was before we took the interest income into consideration. Overall, we look at no deficit for the 2 years running. Instead, we had a surplus. Now, the following slide shows how we allocate the funding in terms of the programs, if you want to call them, or in terms of the operations. Our core business relates to dispute resolution and collective bargaining. Now, in terms of dispute resolution, you look at the first column relating to actual. We have budgeted, in fact, in the second column, 6.6 million. We spend a little bit more. In terms of service delivery, I think we have done excellent when it comes to the allocation and also the use of the funds that have been allocated. We are not in the business of making profit. Whatever is allocated specifically to the operations needs to be used. And 15% of our total budget, 10% of our total budget, sorry, was allocated. And when it comes to the actual, we say 15%, in fact, of the expenditure for that period went to dispute resolution. And now if you also couple the training that I referred to, that is specifically training of dispute resolution practitioners and commissioners through interpreters. This does not relate to training of employees. Now if you add that on to the operations, it's another 6.5%. So which will really take, if you look at dispute resolutions in total, we have allocated more than 20, we have used, in fact, more than 20% if you take the training in support of those services in dispute resolution relates to. And then the dispute prevention support services, which my colleague referred to, when we budgeted, it was 16% was allocated to dispute prevention support services, which is also forming part, a big part of the operations of the council, specifically relating to both dispute resolution and collective bargaining, because the full-time shop stewards render services in both collective bargaining and dispute resolution. Now, the next one, CB, really relates to collective bargaining. So in terms of the core operations of the council, that's the percentage allocation of our funding. And then when we come to governance, I think it's something that we need to have, and also support services. We indicated that we budgeted 2% to go for governance, and definitely in terms of actual money, 2% went to governance. I think governance is an easy thing because it's something which is within our control. We can fairly estimate and budget for it more accurately than in terms of other operations. And then in terms of research, we had allocated 7% and only 1% was used relating to that. However, research also will depend on what comes out of collective bargaining that has been identified as an issue that needs research. And if nothing really comes out of there, that will result in an area where only a smaller percentage than what has been budgeted for has been spent. Now, the project, which includes the teacher laptop initiative, We had allocated 5% in terms of the projects that we would support in terms of the requirements. However, at the end of the year, we realized we only spent even less than 1% of what we expected. If you look at the actual monies, we had allocated over 3 million and only 351,000 was spent on the projects. However, I think reasons have been given in one of those projects by my colleague in her earlier presentation. Now, support services really is something that we classify relates to corporate services, financial services, you know, and the like, management services. We had allocated 11.5% and we ended up spending 15% of the actual money. And then you look at the staff cost, we had budgeted 33% and we came out at 32%, which I think despite the fact that we had some vacancies, those vacancies do not really relate to key areas, which is why even though we did not spend the 23 million allocated, the rate of achievement in terms of the operations of the council was not compromised because of that. Now, if you go to the next slide, we look at the challenges that we have identified in moving forward. I think revenue management is important as we move forward because of the nature of the funding model that we use, whereby we stick with income which does not increase in line with inflation. And we need to ensure that at the early stages where we more than have funds available than what we spend, those are the funds that we accumulate for future years where the need arises, where we need to supplement income to support the operations. And then also there are budgetary constraints that we need to take into consideration, in that when we do our budgets, revenue is also a restriction, because unless you have enough revenue, you cannot really budget for a deficit. So those are the challenges that we need to control and manage them as we move forward. In terms of expenditure, I think, you know, we need to focus more on procurement and contract management. There has been some concerns raised in relation to that. However, I am glad to report that I think the situation is under control. If you look at what really concerns were raised, is if you look at irregular expenditure, you know, it's also related to procurement and contract management. However, if you analyze it further, that did not result in the council incurring any losses. So that's the positive side of those irregular expenditure. Irregular expenditure is expenditure incurred in contravention of any act or any regulation or any law. So as long as we are satisfied that the council did not incur losses in those areas, and steps are being taken to ensure that this does not continue to happen, we are quite satisfied that we have the situation under control. And that is something that will continue in the future. It's not something that, you know, you can say you have pinned it down, it will never happen again. Risk management, I think, is also an area that even the Auditor General had comments on relating to the way we did not have a risk management process done in the year under review. However, I'm glad to report that as we speak, risk management has been done after the end of the financial year. So it will be something that even the new audit committee has started focusing into areas which were raised, and it is the responsibility, in fact, of the audit committee to monitor that risk management is complied with by the management. Now, the next slide to conclude is to conclude. On behalf of the Executive Committee and Audit Committee members, the appreciation to members, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee, in assisting the Council to fulfill its responsibility for the oversight of the quality and integrity of the accounting, auditing, and reporting practices of the ELRC. We further thank you for the valuable time you spent ensuring that the Council does not waver from its role to focus on the qualitative aspects of financial and performance reporting. What gets measured gets done. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks a lot for that. Let us get to the department now. Is there anything that you'd like to say, Ms. Gaya, from the department, or our CFO from the department?
No, Chairperson. I think the report adequately covers the work of the ELRC, so we don't have anything that we would like to add.
Thanks a lot for that. I must thank you for this report. It's very interesting, and it's well set out, because it gives you a deeper understanding now of the ELRC, because normally I struggle when it comes to your oversight function, you know, because a person don't understand everything, but we do have members that, you know, were on the bargaining council and even with outside trade unions, so they have a better understanding of what is taking place. And then we have to congratulate you on your unqualified report with an emphasis on matters. And I'm sure as we go along, members will ask questions on that report because there are some worrying factors, although you covered it, but it still needs to be spoken about. What I'll do now, I'll open the report for questions from our members. I'll start with Honorable Makubela. I'll go to Honorable Bonshana, then Honorable Mishwana, Honorable Lapmo, Honorable Smiles, and I'll come back to Honorable Moni. Let us start in that order. Thank you.
Thanks, Chair. Of course, we need to restrict ourselves to the year under review. But as we always say, we do happen to fall under the current year as well in trying to understand certain things or trying to link both so that we are able to talk to the issues. It may not be that we are not aware what we're dealing with. Just the matters do relate, and we need to be able to be afforded that opportunity to do so. At some point, we had issues in terms of how these disputes are resolved, in the sense that you had various authorities at times dealing with the same issues. You would have issues handled by ELRC, you would have SAIS conducting something else, you would have the department as well doing its own. Have you been able to talk to that issue? We had thought that at some point all the three bodies needed to come together and help clarify how do you honor those so that you don't have them going through all those particular bodies. I just want that clarity because I'm doubtful if that has been done. The second issue I want to raise, you have said that particularly, Ma'am Cindy, you raised an issue that at times within the chamber issues are resolved. Some parties come back later within a short space of time to claim that they want that reviewed. What is the process there? What is the status of a resolution if taken? At what point can parties come back to say, no, no, we don't think this was well thought out. We feel there's need for reviewers. The other issue on the litigations, you're saying once a matter has been at the labor court, and always you are cited as the first respondent, you don't oppose any of those unless your conduct is being questioned or you've got questionable conduct in that process. Other than just you being questioned in terms of conduct, are you just respecting that authority on the basis that legally they're supposed to be the final arbiter of these issues, or there's another underlying principle why you think you can't engage them? The last chair, perhaps, will be relating to, now we're not many today, I think we're few and we still have got quite some time.
Last chair, thank you, but let me make the ruling. You may continue.
Okay. Yes, already I was intimidated by the look as I was to raise the last one, hence I made that statement. In your annual report, the bigger book, you're referring to a challenge to your own constitution in terms of matters of referrals that would refer to or relate to appointments and transfers that the constitution may need to be amended. And in there, you're also talking to the issues that relate to the SGB being the employer, and that you are not able to enforce anything until the SGB itself, as the employer in this case, happened to act on a particular recommendation that you could have made, and then you can engage them. If you seem not aware of that, I can take you to the page, I think, because I see you seem to have an issue. But I think you will know that, Chair, if I don't pick it up quickly, I can just pass. You can refer to the page, not long, but there is that aspect that your question will need to be amended. And I wanted you to talk to that so that we have a better understanding. I think you'll refer to that. H29, yeah, I just couldn't pick it up. And I want you to talk to that issue as to what is the status as well now. There are part of the target and the objectives that we needed to have achieved, and at some point you just say not achieved, but you don't talk to what is the cost, like on page 38. On the rest, you are able to say not achieved, and give reasons. And where it's achieved, it makes sense why, perhaps you can't explain anything. But there are those that are not achieved, but you don't necessarily explain what is the reason, and so on. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you for that. I hope you didn't take all the questions of the other people.
Fine. And I still have got some questions, but if you will allow later, we'll come back.
Honorable Bonshana.
Thank you, Chairperson. I've just got three questions. But before that, let me just comment on the laptop issue. I think this issue was, what adverb should I use, was clumsily handled, the laptop issue. You know, you have the head of state and government from the podium announcing 3 years ago, that teachers are going to get laptops. That is the statement. Now, why have the state, the head of state, announcing this prematurely if either parties, either the basic department or yourselves, were not ready, had not thought through the processes of acquiring these laptops of the teachers? Why create false hopes? It's not good enough. You are are saying you are in the process now of the report, the status report will be coming. I just want to express that feeling. In fact, this links with the other issue, because each time we interrogate the minister, ask the minister, I will say, no, this is still with the chamber or has been taken out of the chamber. This performance assessment agreement for principals and deputy principals is over 3 years again, you know, with the chamber, but I don't see it on the report, but it's current. What is happening there? And that one is not good enough, really. If we our objective is to achieve quality education. Even the Planning Commission report does emphasize that quality education is dependent on good or well-administered schools. Good principals equal quality education. But nothing is happening there. Somebody is holding this process to ransom. Is it yourselves bargaining there? What is happening there? Can we have some light on that one? The last one is on the appointments and promotions. KwaZulu is the highest. I would like to know, there are two groups of unions there. Is it possible to throw some light from which group will these complaints on appointments and promotions be coming? The SATU group or the other group, DATU, NAPTOSA group? Why I'm saying this, because this will strengthen my argument somewhere else. Because I've always argued that the interview panels and the appointment processes must be reviewed, because something wrong is happening there. In fact, we had at one stage this current year, in fact, we had one union in one province complaining bitterly that promotions to principalship and inspectorship favored one union. Because of what is happening there in the panel interviews and appointment processes. So that's why I'm asking my question, from which section or site will these complaints on appointments be coming, to strengthen my argument on the other issue. And also, lastly, sir, the same applies to, if you look at unfair labor practices, the majority will be coming from, the bulk of this will be coming from Western Cape, 117. Would you explain the politics behind that? Can you enlighten us? Why is that? Or you are as, you can't say you are as blank as ourselves. You know? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson. Allow me also to start by appreciating the fact that we are sitting with, well-formulated a report in front of us. Because for the first time I see, are you aware that our names are appearing here? All of us. So I think this is well done, and you did not, you see, you didn't see it. And we don't have to say yellow and while we're having something photocopied. I think that's commendable. But I have three questions. The first one is, on the promotional dispute issues. I think those had national issues are many, so I interpret it as they are heading the list. Now my concern is there fairness in this promotion? Because if people keep on complaining each time there is a promotion, we need to check if there is fairness. How do you check the issue of fairness in promotion? I say people know for a fact after interviews were held that the person who gets the post is the person who really qualifies and not informed by any other thing. That's the question that I wanted to put as the first one. The second one, on Resolution 1 of 2011, on remuneration of national markers, I was always concerned for a long time, actually, for the 35 years that I taught before I came here. I was concerned why people pay only those markers who go and sit down mark grade 12. Why can't you sit down and analyze the fact that every educator from grade R to grade 12 is marking at the end of the year? Do you pay people who sit at a particular boardroom and they are marking grade 12 only, and you call that fairness? Because sooner or later, politically speaking, we'll be sitting with a challenge that not only the grade 12 people are marking, every educator is marking. Can we ask you, or can I ask you, to go and reassess the whole issue of, or rather, no marker must be paid, because everybody is paid at the end of it. I mean, where educators are paid, all of them, I would argue vehemently that the grade R educator should definitely get what the grade 12 educator is getting. And I hope somebody hears me in this world. The next one, the educators, I need to echo this one. I know some people talk about it. The educators' laptop thing. Politically speaking, is it a support decision? Because unless we sit down here and face issues head on, definitely the president, we know our president is very much normal. He cannot stand there and say that this is going to happen. And it does not happen. What does it mean? Who is making sure that it doesn't happen? Is somebody making sure that it doesn't happen so that at the end of the, maybe at the end of the term or whatever, people will be holding him on this? I mean, he said it must be done, and it should be done. And we want to be told as to why can't it happen. He could not have said that if he didn't know that the finances will ensure that this particular thing happens. We need help from you. Remember we said together we can definitely. And if our togetherness, there are people who are making sure that we don't do more, so that they sit down and say, hi, these people have talked, this laptop issue must be solved. That's a matter of agency, I guess. And lastly, just to ask you to unpack your two statues. You were talking of Statue of the Union. I understand you say some are in the case, and stuff, but I don't understand why you put them as statue. And I saw another statue. It's like, what's the difference? Because if they are statue, the last time I checked, you were a statue member, whether you were coming from the Eastern Cape or wherever. But now I saw, are we having two statues sitting within the ELRC? Yeah, and in conclusion, because some people concluded, I want to inform you, those who do not know, that when the ELRC started, I was the chair, and I was so clumsy, trust me. I remember sitting next to Daya. No, National, don't ask questions, I'm not talking to you. Yeah, Chairperson, please protect me. Yeah, I have to congratulate you because I remember, trust me, I was told to chair and I sat next to Daya Gavenda. There was a program in front of me and I said, Daya, what now? And Daya showed me number one, opening. I said, yes, I see it, but what must I do with this? So he said, funny. It's opening. I said, come on, it come with remarks. You know, it was like sharing sitting next to me. But I see that the ELFC has grown, and I thank God we were there when it started and didn't know what you were doing. I think you know what you're doing now. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chairperson. I do not come from a union background or have any experience of bargaining councils, etc. So the questions I ask are possibly uninformed, but I need to be informed, obviously, to better understand. And I'm sure that you will assist with that. Chair, I think my colleague from the IFP has very eloquently covered the issue of both the teacher laptop initiative and, very importantly, the performance contracts for principals and deputy principals. I'm always amazed that he manages to find words like clumsily handled. I might have put it somewhat stronger. But in terms of the... yes, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. I have great admiration for that. In terms of the performance contracts for principals and deputy principals, the Minister has announced that by January these will be in place. When we questioned this in the House, there was a question session to the social services cluster, which includes basic education. Minister wasn't present, and the Deputy Minister, Enver Surti, answered. He said that not only will there be performance contracts in place for principals and deputy principals, but also for all teachers from January 2013. Well, I think I said 2012. From January 2013, which is good news. But I fail to understand how either the minister or the deputy minister can say that until the ELRC processes are concluded. So I've got two questions there, and it might refer to last year or this year. Nowhere in the document, as my colleague quite rightly said, is it reflected at all. So I have got no way of knowing. The first question is this. As far as I recall, came to the Labour Relations Council in 2008. So it's been with the ELRC for 4 years. 4 years. What happens in those 4 years? I mean, is somebody actually working actively on it, or does it just sit there? Does it just sit there? And then the second question is, yes, I think exactly what my colleague asked, where is it now, and how does that link with the minister's pronouncement? Also linked with that is research. Very little of the budget is spent on research. Now, this might be a bad example, but the question was asked of me. I don't know the answer. I attended a conference recently of the Education Law Association, and I indicated to them that the minister had indeed made this announcement that there would be these performance contracts in place from January 2013, and most of the people there are academics. One of them stood up and they said, on what research is this based? What research informs the assertion that having a performance contract is going to improve, in fact, leadership in schools or accountability or whatever it might improve. I don't think anybody doubts, because there's certainly research on that. Nobody doubts the linkage between having a good principal and good outcomes in schools. But in terms of performance contracts, his question was, and this is a senior academic, his name is Johan Beckman, in the education world. I couldn't answer him, but you are actively involved in negotiating towards the achievement of something that is not necessarily based on research. How actively involved are you in researching whether it is indeed a good thing to negotiate towards or not? Chairperson, okay, let me try and be very brief on the other questions. Training of the various bodies. One of the problems that appears to prevail is that unions are not aware of picketing rules. Picketing rules are actually very peculiar with respect to schools, because picketing is allowed at the premises of the employer. Now, a school doesn't employ a teacher unless it's a school governing body teacher. The province employs a teacher. So picketing is actually not allowed at schools. Outside of schools, picketing is allowed outside of provincial education departments, and that's it. So picketing rules are actually, as I say, rather peculiar in the education environment, and they're certainly not adhered to. It's an area of great concern and an area that needs attention. How involved are you in training unions on things like that? Unprotected strikes, like the Go Slow in the Eastern Cape at the beginning of the year, that just went on and on and on. How involved are you with the unions? I mean, I would think that's part of dispute prevention. And then just two last quick questions. Your challenges that you referred to, I found it rather interesting that all of those challenges are internal. Now, I realize this is an annual report for last financial year, but we are in South Africa. I mean, we have to acknowledge the South Africa in which we are today, and developments such as Marikana, where the unions actually were ignored, where the employer was negotiating with the leader of the protesters and not regarding the unions, where many provisions of labor relations, of the Labor Relations Act, were entirely ignored. That's a risk. That's a major risk going forward. The risks that you've identified, your challenges that you've identified, are all internal. None of them are external. There appears to be a greater militancy within the union that isn't identified by you as a risk or challenge. And I'm concerned about that. My last concern is about sexual offenders and, let's say first, you spoke a lot about dismissals or cases involving children as victims, and then you also spoke about sexual offenders on page 36 of your annual report. You spoke about special hearings involving the child as victims, a victim or a witness, and then the very last thing here is to file an award with SAPS Child Protection Unit Safe Sexual Offenders Register. Not achieved is indicated, and the reason is that the procedure is still to be clarified as to whose responsibility it is to file these awards, which is frightening. It is really frightening. But I don't fully understand why you are dealing with these are misconduct cases. I mean, if I look at your... I'm sorry, Chair, this is the last question, and I will be finished in a minute. If I look at the nature of your disputes, there are things like promotions, unfair labor practice, unfair dismissal, interpretation, application, etc., BCEA. I don't see any misconduct there, unless it comes in with unfair dismissal. Where does it sit, this issue about cases involving children as victims, and particularly in sexual abuse cases, where you might have the need to put a name on the sexual offenders register, with which there are so many problems anyway. But where does that come in, and why is it not dealt with by SAFE? My understanding certainly is that SAFE deals with misconduct, not the ERRC. So if you could explain that, I would be extremely grateful. Thank you very much, Chair.
person here the benefit or the disadvantage of speaking last is that you've got nothing to say. I've got the generic question or the favorite question. I want to ask the LRC, that you buy value for money with your budget. And that you bought at any benefits for your end users, that you contribute with your spending to achieving outcome one, which is a national priority, quality basic education. Are you happy? Can you say here today, sorry, Chair, I'm not taking your position under oath. Yes, you are happy that you contributed to achieve outcome one. Then, Chair, also generic. Yes, okay. Thank you. Chair, then on risk management, it's a challenge. And it was said by the LRC they are working on risk management. Can I then ask whether internal auditing is being done or are you outsourcing? And if you outsource, do you want to sort of reconsider and do your own thing internally? Chair, and then lastly, and not in financial terms with regard to risk management, are our learners at risk of the trade unions, of not receiving what they constitutionally should be receiving? Thank you.
Okay, thanks. First of all, apologies for coming in late, and my head's all over the place in a million different committees, so I probably have missed, and what I will ask may have been covered, so I'm sorry about that. My colleagues have well covered me on a lot of issues, but what I haven't sort of picked up or heard in the time that I've been here was just that you recorded irregular expenditure, and that was attributed to a lack of skills, a lack of knowledge, lack of dedicated person to deal with the supply chain issues, and also recorded fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Was that the same reason? But why I'm asking is, what is being done about that? What are the problems around that? Is there something that we should be doing in connection with why that's not what it should be? Thanks.
Thanks, Chair. Maybe I should also appreciate the account that the ELRC has made for the financial year 11-12. Maybe I should also add my voice among those who are congratulating the Council for the positive audit outcome. My first question relates to unionization in the sector, if I should call it a sector. What percentage of the workforce in the sector is unionized? My second question relates to disputes of interest. You have only 0.4%. Then that tells me that 99.6% were disputes of right. I might be wrong. Maybe I should be clarified there. Of right. The question on promotions has been covered. Okay. 29% of grievances have not been resolved. Just want to know as to for how long have these grievances existed. lastly, except for saying there were no strikes in the period under review, I've not heard anything about the labor relations climate for that period. I know that you have dealt with this, all sorts of disputes. But what I would have loved to hear is your analysis of your labor relations situation for that period, let's say for a year. That would have enabled maybe the parties involved in negotiations to brace themselves somehow come the bargaining period. Thanks.
I think the questions that I want to raise were taken. But I think, you know, the question that Honorable Dudley asked, it's also a very important question, because the Auditor General made it very clear to us that for the amount of money you receive, that irregular and wasteful expenditure is just legal. You are not satisfied. I don't know whether I'm putting it correctly, but that's what he said to us when we had a meeting with him on Tuesday morning. Because he said, compared to the amount that you received, that amount is very big. And I think in the future, you have to just be careful when it comes to this expenditure. And then the other thing is this, you spoke about your budgetary constraints. Tell us, because like you said, you're managing within your budget, whether the budget you are receiving, because look, this is BRRR period, is it enough to do your work? And if it is not, what are your needs, worries? Thank you. You may answer, sir. We'll start with you.
I'm sorry, may I have just a quick thing, two-finger on Honourable Morney's question. With respect to the strikes, why is the go slow in the Eastern Cape not listed? That was a withholding of labour and it constituted a strike and took place within this financial year, but it's not indicated in your report. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I would like to thank honorable members for their congratulations on our achievements, including the unqualified report. Thank you very much. We really appreciate that. We try and improve each year as we go forward. Thank you very much. Chair, I will try to answer the questions. I think there's quite a number of them. And please, I will ask apologies up front if I might have left some of the questions or maybe not have covered them properly. And maybe to ensure that I do justice, I'll start with the last and go back, because already even if I go back, I think some of them I might have maybe lost them along the way. Now, the budgetary constraint. Is the budget you receive enough? Just a point of clarification. We don't get a budget as such. We don't get a transfer as that. We don't get an allocation as that. Our monies, as a bargaining council. A bargaining council? Yeah.
Because an outcome comes out from you, but do you need anything from the department?
What? Yeah. Okay. I would say, in our case, the state happens to be the employer.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the Labor Relations Act, we look at them as employer-employee. I might have maybe to clarify that later. However, I think in terms of legislative requirement, it is the employer and the employee who need to contribute on a 50-50 basis. An employee. So it is being done. So at the moment, we deduct or we receive 5 rand from the educator and 5 rand from the employer. And if you look at our results, we have accumulated surpluses. And I cannot say at this stage we don't have enough. I think at the moment we have enough. I would say until the end of 2016, in terms of the MTEF period, we do have enough. I do, in my capacity as the Chief Financial Officer, draw the attention of the parties that we should start the negotiations. 2 years before, we get into trouble of having to be faced with a deficit and having to reduce our operations. I would say at the moment, I cannot say I don't have enough, because if I have reported that I've got a surplus, then it indicates that we still have enough in terms of the budget. So I hope that will answer the question. Now, irregular and wasteful expenditure. Wasteful expenditure is expenditure that is incurred in vain, that could have been avoided. And sometimes, maybe because we would like to be transparent, we would like to indicate that even though maybe it's on the borderline, it's a gray area, it could not have been avoided. I think if you look at our report, there is about 95,000 relating to SARS. And that is interest for late payment. Now, if you look at that latest late payment interest, what is the cost? Because you need to go back and say, what is the cost? And the cost was mainly because we were moving into electronic funds transfers. And it happened that those who would release the payment were not informed about the change within that environment. And I would say it's something that we would say it's an error, really, rather than something which could have prevented. But we wanted to be transparent and say, you know, it really is wasteful, you know, because we should have paid before the 7th of the month. So I would say most of the wasteful expenditure, really, sometimes you cannot even avoid. But we highlight them in order to get assistance from the parties to try and reduce, if not eliminate it. Let me give you another example. We call a meeting, or there is training scheduled, and all the logistics are done, and in the end, the principals of one of the parties informs the delegate that there is an urgent issue that needs to be attended to, and that delegate will not be attending. And the cost associated with that, whether it's accommodation, well, travel, you can recover if it's an air flight. If it's a hired car, you cannot pick it up. However, there are certain costs like accommodation. If you don't show up, it's a wasteful expense. Now, how would you prevent it from an urgent thing arising from the principal that you need to attend to this? You cannot go for training, or you cannot go for a bargaining meeting. So those are the type of wasteful expenditures that we are talking about. I think here it's more of transparency than really saying it's, you know, it's really that wasteful expenditure the way we understand it. Now, I'll come to irregular expenditure. Irregular expenditure also is expenditure which is against the law or regulations or whatever. Now, In terms of the requirements of the constitution of the ELRC, we are required to calculate and audit the vote waste. That is, we need to go out there through the PESAL system and ensure that we allocate the membership of the unions, because the PESAL system has got that information. And there are deadlines within which those issues should be done. And unfortunately, in one of these cases, where you need to engage the auditors at the last minute, it was picked up at the last minute. However, it's something that needs to be done. But it was irregular, because before you could enter into that, you should have gone out and called for proposals. But then, you know, we had to weigh between the urgent issue of it having to be done as per the Constitution before the end, say, of the calendar year. Because what if it's delayed? Then I think the consequences might be too ghastly to contemplate, because now dealing with the unions, they would like to have that information, and it might even cause other problems. So you have to apply your mind and say, is this, you know, in that sense, is this? But however, in terms of disclosure, let's disclose it. So that, you know, sometimes I think it helps in that once you know this is going to be disclosed, this is going to be monitored, you tend to think twice before you do this type of things. And again, in terms of the audit services, sorry, the internal audit services, we used to share the services of the internal audit with the Department of Basic Education. And when it became clear for them that they could no longer, they don't have the capacity to also serve us, we were notified, and unfortunately, we had to do the internal audit function within that year. And we did not go out again for proposals or for quotations, but this was a service which is less than 500,000. And what we did was, we go to another entity within the education sector and say, they have gone through the process of appointing that internal audit. In this case, we went to Umalusi and said, who are you using for internal audit services? And then they provided us with the name. And we said, okay, look, you know, it's too late to go out and do those things, because this is a function that needs to be done. And we appointed them to do the internal audit work. However, in terms of the Auditor General, we did not follow the procedure. But you see, the way we look at it is, you know, if I go to an entity within the education sector, I think, yes, the letter of the law was not complied with. But, you know, you have to apply your mind. But I think in the end we say we will disclose it in that, you know, this is what. So the majority of those irregular and wasteful expenditure, they would be along those lines. However, we are not condoning it. We will try and ensure that the you know, compliance is emphasized in all the things that we do. Talking about the internal audit function, whether it's outsourced or internal function, in fact, at the moment, there has been a decision to fund that post internally, because we outsource this function. And then the decision has been taken and it will be funded. Now we have to go through the process of recruitment. Well, firstly, I think we have already done the specs for that position, and it will even include more than the normal internal audit relating to financial information, because now we are going into performance information. We are going to be audited on that. That will also include, it will extend the scope into also the internal function relating to all the processes involved on the strategic plans, annual performance plans, because I think as from the next financial year, an audit opinion needs to be stressed. It should be given by the Auditor General in terms of performance information. So, yes, we are looking at that, and there's a funded vacancy which has been approved. Now, the process is we need to ensure that we get the right person. The analysis of the labor relation environment. I think it came from this side. I would like to be honest. I think it's a very good thing that we have brought out, and I think it's something that we need to do. And it's not really, we have never really gone into gathering that type of information. And the point is accepted, and we will need to definitely to do that. Yes, it's accepted. 29% of the disputes not resolved. I think somewhere in the annual report, we have indicated cases that have been carried forward. I think they start back from 2005-2006, and we do indicate, because some of the cases definitely they take years to resolve. However, as at the end of the reporting period that we are reviewing, as normal, all disputes referred in the last quarter of the financial year will definitely still be outstanding. That is, dispute referred from January, February, March of 2012, definitely, they are still outstanding. So there will always be outstanding disputes at the reporting period because of that. However, what we can report on is the backlog relating to that has definitely been reduced, which is supported by, remember the graph I provided about the increase in the processes that we do. So some of them really relates to those which came from way back in 2005, 2006. Yes, clarification. Sure.
I'm not talking about disputes. I'm talking about grievances.
Okay. I think, yes, thanks for the clarification. I think when we talk about grievances really are at the level of the employer. It's something which we would like to use to ensure that we prevent disputes. So I think maybe I may not be the appropriate person to really talk with authority relating to grievances, because we are saying we want to assist in looking at the grievances as the cause of disputes. And once we look at that and try to assist the employer or the employee, and also taking into consideration that we still have to keep our impartiality, we still need to keep that. So I would say I'm not in a position to maybe provide you with the correct answer when it relates. That is right. Thank you. Yes, that's right.
Now, what we have to do today, because it seems out a reason, that was the reason.
I think there was also a question of grievance. Disputes of right and dispute of interest. I'm not sure whether I captured it correctly. Did any of my colleagues capture that issue? Or maybe I may ask the Honorable. No, disputes of right and dispute of interest.
Chair, I was saying, disputes of interest constitutes only 0.4% of disputes recorded or reported. I just wanted to find out as to whether that implies that 99.6% were disputes of right.
Thank you for the clarification. I would say yes. That's correct. And then the unionization.
Yes, I'm addressing you, Chair. I'm addressing you, Chair. Can I chip in? Yes, please. We non-unionists, what is the dispute of right and the dispute of interest? He's a unionist, you know, he knows what to talk about. We on the side, on the side, don't you?
Maybe I will explain the difference in terms of an understanding from the angle of a trade unionist. A dispute of right is a dispute in which you can't go on strike. You follow all the procedures and processes until you get to arbitration. Of course, arbitration is something that you have to both parties have to agree to. Maybe until you get to court, where a final decision is legally made and binding. On a dispute of interest, parties simply go to CCMA when they cannot resolve. They ask for a certificate, in which case they have to give the employer 48 hours and they go on strike legally. Maybe I think I've summarized it. Thank you very much for the clarification, and I think it has been done very correctly. Thank you very much. Going back again, I think there's the issue of, I think, fruitless and irregular expenditure. I think I've explained the cause when I was responding to something else and also why. Are our learners at risk with the unions? I think I would be wrong to say I can answer that question on behalf of the ELRC. It's more of a societal issue, because I think one of the legislative mandates, if not the legislative compliance, I've indicated that you've got the right to strike. Because I think when we look about learners and unions, we are saying maybe they don't have the right to strike. But, you know, within the confines that I am allowed to respond, within my mandate I've mentioned earlier, I think it may not be possible for me to go outside that mandate and respond to as to whether our learners are at risk with the unions. If you may allow me, Chair, please. Risk management, internal audit, outsourcing, I think I've responded to that when I was responding to something else. Value for money in relation to outcome. I think the ELRC gets a good return in terms of what we invest. I have no doubt that the allocation of funding does not bear any fruit in terms of the investments that we make. And again, we need to also be aware that it's a legislative requirement that certain things need to be done,
And I think unless, you know, we invest in the and try to improve, especially the quality and the turnaround times in terms of the services that we do, I think each and everything really needs to be funded. And I think it's a good return on the investment. Oh yeah, yes, yes. The total number of members of the union, I would ask my colleague to maybe assist me from her side, because I know the total number of educators that contribute to my levies. She should know, hopefully, the number of educators as they come through the vote weeks. Can you remember the total? Because you see, we do an analysis of the members of each and every union, because that's what we do when we say vote weights, because each and every union is entitled to representation by the weight of the number of their members. We have that number. I might have to provide it to you later on, which will be compared to the 412,000 that I say they contribute to me, but definitely they are less than that. It's not all who are unionized. So I know who are contributing, and all those who contribute are not all union members. Uh-huh. But share through you, I will come back and provide it to the portfolio committee. The next one I think relates to explain the cases for the child victims. Where does it sit? I think when we talk about cases involving the child as a victim or the child as a witness, let me give you an example of cases that we, by way of example, maybe I will clarify what we deal with. It would be a case where a teacher has been dismissed because of sexual abuse. So it will come to us as somebody referring a dispute because he has been dismissed. Now, through the process, that will involve the child. And again, the other one would be if he is dismissed because he applied corporal punishment to the child. You see, that's the way they come to us in that way. It's got nothing, because we are not involved in the professional discipline of the educators. That is the area that SACE is involved with. So those are the type of cases that we deal with in relating to the child as a victim or as a witness. The Marikana issue. Why has that not been identified as a risk? I think if I'm correct, you're coming from the point that there are different types of categories of risks, internal, external. And when you look at the external, we talk about the environmental risks. That is the risks that can come or flow from the environment within which you operate. Now, do we really take that into consideration? I think maybe after Marikana, in our next Lohodla, when we really look at this issue, then yes, those environmental issues will come into play. However, before then, when we looked at the environment, there were no high risks involved, because mostly, you know, we rank these risks because you cannot deal with them all. Some, you know, if we can tolerate them or control them, you know, they will get a lower rank. We'll only look at the higher. Maybe next time it might fall in the high ranking risk and then it will be attended to. The next one is the training. Do we train dispute resolution? solution practitioners, specifically from the unions, about picketing? I would say not yet. It's not at the top of our list, because, to be honest, there are funding restrictions, because, you know, we don't have that money that we can do everything, but, you know, we prioritize them, and that, according to the ELRC's analysis, is really at the bottom of the list. What research informs the performance contract? Maybe I need to go back, because I tend to think it's outside the mandate of the ELRC. I tend to think in that way. It's not really within the mandate of the ELRC for me to be able to answer. But I think this is related to the instrument also. Am I correct? Is it related to the instrument?
Chairperson, I used it as an example because it was a very real example where I had been asked a question and could not answer. But the fact is that you are engaged in negotiations to achieve an outcome, and you as a body are not privy, often, I'm sure, to research that informs the necessity for that outcome. So therefore, do you research, for instance, if you could say to unions, and please take this from whence it comes, from an uninformed point of view, but if you could say to unions, look, if this is in place, you will achieve ABC, that are all really good outcomes, they are going to be these benefits for you, for the environment within which you work, for the children that you serve, etc. If you are able to say that based on really good research, surely it must assist you in achieving an outcome. But where does that research come from? Who is responsible for providing that research? Not necessarily with the performance contract. That was just an example. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for the clarification. Let me see if my colleague can respond to that, and then I'll add where I think it's necessary. Could we ask my colleague to... Yeah, Cindy.
Fine. Thanks, Chairperson. To you, can I also use the same example of the performance agreement system that is currently being discussed? Yes. I think, Chair, if perhaps we can place this issue of performance agreement in context, perhaps that will assist in going forward. Members will recall that, and I'm happy because at least there is reference to Collective Agreement Number 1 of 2008. They would recall that there was a teacher development summit, which in preparation for that teacher development summit, extensive research was done in terms of looking at the existing policies and regulations in terms of education, what instrument is there, and what is this instrument being used for. Then emanating from such, there was a decision that then mandated the ELRC to look at this whole concept of performance management system, not only linking it or focusing only on the contract itself, but review the performance management system for educators, which then talks to from post level 1 up to the highest post level that you have. Hence, we talk about announcement that was made by the Deputy Minister, which indicated that this is not only focusing on the principals and the deputy principals, it's looking at the whole school, starting from post level 1, because we are talking about reviewing performance management system. We are not only talking about the contract, the total review. Then, Chairperson, we had a collective agreement, one of 2008, which had a collective agreement number 2 of 2008, which spoke to the process matters that had to be followed by the ELRC. ELRC referring to parties in this instance, in terms of taking out certain aspects of that agreement, which required further research to be conducted to inform the process going forward. So I can confirm, Chairperson, that indeed research was conducted in terms of that agreement. We sent teams to various various countries, just that I can't recall offhand right now. But it was different countries. North America was there. Central America was there. India and Thailand, some countries in Africa was there. And that research was conducted by parties themselves, supported by experts from HSRC. Coming back from that exercise, parties then looked at the findings in terms of the good practices that they had brought back from that exercise. Then after that exercise was done, they then looked at the recommendations, of course, informed by the findings there. Then after that, the department also conducted its own research on IQMS, because as we all agree that policy making and involves evidence-based policy formulation. So they evaluated what policy was there in terms of performance management system. I think the employer rep can confirm to that, because we've got records that have been tabled that confirm what I'm just saying, that IQMS, there was research conducted in terms of IQMS, in terms of its successes and failures. So in short, Chairperson, I want to confirm that indeed this work that parties are currently engaging, with the reference again, I want to put emphasis to the review of the performance management system, of which the contract is just but part of the whole system. The research was done. Whether that research will be acceptable in terms of the academic standards or not, that's perhaps an engagement for a later stage, not right now, because I cannot confirm that indeed the researchers, the academics will find that acceptable in terms of their standards. And further to that, Chairperson, again, clarifying the issue of the process of collective bargaining and linking it to performance contracts, because I think those two, they talk to each other. Members will recall that in our report last year, we indicated that that was work in progress. And indeed, this report for the year under review is showing that that aspect that we reported on, which talked to the finalization of recommendations by task team. Hence, earlier on, I clarified that work is subjected to task team where the actual work is done. Once there are recommendations there, that then gets to be subjected to collective bargaining, where parties negotiate on the drafts that are there. Now, at that point in time, you do not have a collective agreement, Honorable Makuba. You don't have a collective agreement wherein you can come back and say parties have come back and review their position in terms of the existing collective agreement. Parties will come and say, whilst we acknowledge that work has been done in terms of the task team itself, but however, we are coming with a different view, which is in the main, that explains the delay in terms of concluding the work of the finalization of the review of the performance management system, because the work had been done by the task team. Then in the mandate-seeking processes, then parties came with their positions to say, in response to this document, which we had subjected to our principals for mandate, this is our position in terms of how we take the process forward. Hence, then, there is a delay in terms of that which we had envisaged to be concluded in the year that we are reporting for. And again, linking that perhaps to the commitments that are being made, the commitment and the intent is still there from all parties, being the employer and the employee. Perhaps that could be, I'm not trying to explain why there are deadlines being set in Parliament, as the other members have indicated, but perhaps that could be the deadline that all parties at Council are expected towards to, so that come that period that parliamentarians have been given, as that process having been concluded, then there shall have been an instrument that can be taken out there and implemented, Chairperson. But work is taking place at Council, and all parties are committed into concluding the met. And in actual fact, we can confirm that there was a meeting that had started, but it's still going to continue in whether now in October or in November. So it is obviously envisaged that by next year that work shall have been concluded. Then, Chair, in terms of through you and my accounting officer here, in terms of the teacher laptop initiative, perhaps we must clarify.
Thank you for the. But to be honest with you, I'm sitting, if somebody asked me what is happening with that agreement, collective bargaining, I wouldn't be in a position to tell that person what the position is. I haven't heard you, to be honest with you. What are the sticking points there? What is it? What is happening there? Especially with performance agreement for principals and deputy principals, because that was a specific issue. Because we're told at one stage that no, all other unions have agreed to this collective agreement. A certain group has not, it has withdrawn and has formed its own task team. What is it? Because we're getting conflicting accounts of what is happening. Would you put us into your confidence and tell us exactly what sticking points, what are the sticking points? Thank you.
Chair, I can confirm that in principle there are no sticking points, except to say that after the work of the task team, wherein parties had gone to seek mandates, they then came back to express their different views. And equally, Chairperson, we don't have a decision of council or a record of council that indicated any of our parties, like the honourable member there is indicating that they had put on record that some unions were ready to sign. We don't have such, Chairperson, because it was still work in progress. Parties were still engaging on the document. And as of right now, it is still work in progress. They are still engaging. It is envisaged that at some point in time, that work, when that work has been concluded, then perhaps we shall prepare a special report and submit it to the accounting officer to appraise the members of the portfolio committee on the development.
Can we have the document?
And once they have the document, then they'll give it to the CEO, the acting CEO. Then we can get it. Because it is being indicated it's work in progress. The work is going on. And there's no party that stood back. All right. I'll start with Honorable Marco Bela.
Chair, I want to try and appeal for us to allow them to go through all the questions and conclude. Any follow-ups that will need to come, we'll make them thereafter, after having a fair share of what the responses are on all the questions. Otherwise, we'll be stuck in one or two, and the rest will not be answered, and I don't think it will be useful for the committee as a whole. We'll still come to this question.
Mm-hmm.
Even some of us have some follow-ups, probably, but we don't necessarily want to interject now from time to time. We want to allow space for conclusion of those responses. We'll then have our time, if time permits, to do that.
Thanks a lot for that, because to me, it was dialogue taking place now.
I thought a man from the kingdom would have preferential treatment.
Look here, Honorable Lovewell, it does work according to the ruling, because I still got one question of yours that I still want answered before we go to the laptop. So let us go on.
Yeah, Chairman, I'm going to call a point of order, and that's with respect to providing clear answers. We are not getting to say parties are engaging. Doesn't mean anything, quite frankly. I don't know what parties do when they engage. So if a question is answered, parties are engaging is not an answer. If a question is asked, it is not an answer. So as we go forward, please can we be more specific than parties are engaging?
I think I'm not going to take it as a point of order, because when it's engagement, people are speaking. And speaking is taking place when it comes to this agreement. Let us go on before we go to laptops. The one on the Eastern Cape. because, you know, we're going to complete the Honourable Lovemore's questions now. And it's linked to that one of money when it comes to no strikes. Because when it comes to one of your pages in your presentation, you do speak about developments in the Eastern Cape Chamber. And I think that will refer, because look at it, it's an MOU. We all heard about, not the MOU, we heard about the MOA. I don't know which page it is, because the pages are not numbered, but it comes, it falls under collective bargaining. It's after collective bargaining program 2-1 to third page. Thank you. And then we're going on to the left. We're going on to Honorable Mushwana's question.
Can you assist me in understanding the question? I hear you referring to the MOA and the current development.
What happened, the Honourable Mommy asked you the question on no strike. And you wanted an analysis of the labour relations plan. But another member in the committee that seemed to be and said about something to split in the committee. So was that the grievance? What?
Can I request members to refer to page 29 of the actual report, the last paragraph there. I think this the question is clarified, is answered by that paragraph, because it's making reference to the strike that, or the go slow that took place in that chamber,
yeah.
I mean in the province itself. So it's the last paragraph of page 29. So it is reported on Shepherd's.
I think there was a, I wouldn't say a strike, there was a dispute. There was a dispute. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, not really that strike, you know, there was a dispute.
So with reference to laptop, our report was trying to say that, picking up from the report that was contained in the previous year, wherein we were explaining the role that is played by the ENRC in facilitating the discussions between the employer and the teacher unions towards the implementation of the teacher laptop initiative. In the process of doing that work, Chair, there were those problems that were picked up. But the commitment and the intent from the state as well as from the side of the union, it is still there. But however, we were trying to clarify that the laptop initiative has not been implemented as of right now. And these are the hindrances that are being currently being worked on. Hence the need for the government to review the funding, because that was the only problematic area. Because as members would recall, The teacher laptop initiative would have been funded by the state subsidizing the teachers for a certain percentage of the payment, and then the difference being carried by the individual teacher itself. Then that required that such individuals are subjected to profiling in terms of the National Credit Act. And in the process of that profiling, that's when then these problems were picked up to say that, despite the fact that the state is offering assistance in terms of the subsidy itself, the individual is unable to enjoy the benefit because of this, which is outside the control of all parties that are involved in the process. In other words, we are not giving that information as an indication that the process or the teacher laptop initiative has been discarded off or has been abandoned. We are giving the status of progress as of in terms of March, say 2012, in terms of our reporting period. So the problem is only in the implementation part, which part is in terms of government having to review the funding process, is currently trying to address the hindrance that is there.
And
sorry, Chair, maybe just a point of clarification. We have indicated, as the ELRC, the mandate, basically, and also the core business of the ELRC. Now, the objective of establishing a public entity, according to my understanding, is to ensure implementation of objectives of its executive authority. So those additional projects that we would be involved in is not really the projects of the ELRC as such. Those would be in collaboration with the executive authority, which is the department. I think, you know, then there comes a point, because we as the ELRC, you know, the mandate, you know, within which we operate does not include that. However, in collaboration with the executive authority, those are the things that we would do in terms of the agreement. I think
In terms of that matter that was raised by the honourable member, wherein she was raising a concern of the exclusion of the other categories of educators. So what we can indicate is that currently, in fact, not necessarily currently, perhaps I should start with what we have reported to the members before. We had reported that the LRC had commissioned the research by CEPD. The LRC had commissioned the research by CEPD in terms of the appropriateness of the salary structure for educators. And in that report, in the research itself, there were some recommendations. And parties had indicated, Chairperson, that they are looking at the report in terms of lifting up specific areas that they can take into consideration in looking at the overall remuneration of educators. So at this point in time, indeed, we can confirm that indeed the remuneration for markers is only for grade 12. Perhaps in the long term, if such recommendations are coming up and filtered through to those who come with proposals at the ELRC level for engagement, perhaps that could be a matter that our parties can look at. And also, Chairperson, added to that CEPD research, we also need to draw the attention of the members to the recent PSCBC collective agreement. That too has mandated the sectors to look at the areas of remuneration. In other words, education being dealt with at ELRC. So that could be another area that can be considered in taking the process forward.
Okay. That relates to appointments and promotion, am I correct? Yeah. I think there is a process in place in terms of recruitment, advertising, shortlisting, and selection and appointment. However, the SGB would make the recommendation. Now, during the process that I've indicated, both parties are there, even unions are present. So I would say the process is fair, the process is transparent when it relates to that. However, the outcome thereof, I think it's something which maybe as the ELRC would not be in a position to comment, because the way we look at it, the process is fair because the parties are represented during the process up until the SGP will recommend the appointment. So I think the question was, is there fairness?
Yes.
I would say there is fairness because what more could one do when it's open to all parties to observe the process? So my answer would be, yes, it's fair. Maybe let me also take this opportunity to unpack Satu for her, to unpack Satu. You see, there we talk about combined trade union. And when we talk about combined trade union, it's for those who don't meet the threshold. Because there are thresholds in order for you to be admitted as a party to the council. For instance, if you are a party who does not have, say, more than, I think at the moment it's 50,000 members, you cannot come in as a party because you don't have enough members to be admitted. However, provision is those smaller ones, to afford them also representation, those smaller ones can come together and make the threshold, and then we say this is combined trade union. Now, when it comes to SATU, when you look at SATU, it's combined trade union SATU, but it is made up of SATU and CTPA. Now, CTPA is Cape Teachers Professional Association. So that's how, it's not two SATUs. It's only that the combined trade union is named SATU because SATU is in the majority there. And then while the other parties, I mean, there are more than five, I think. You look at HOSPESA. HOSPESA doesn't really have enough members. You look at PEU. Even NAPTOSA doesn't have enough members on its own to make the threshold. And I think it's also a question of cost consideration, efficiency considerations. Because in the end, you might end up with, I don't know how many parties to the council. But however, that's how the structure is, and also is per agreement of the parties in the council, because they decide to increase or to decrease. What was the next one? Thank you. Thank you, Chair. I think from the information that we as the ELRC has, we don't see any of that because a referral form is a public document, and again, we don't really ask reasons because, as always, we will try to maintain our impartiality. We need to be aware of that. So we don't see that because I think that would not really come into the picture because then it means our impartiality might be questioned if we start interpreting things as political or otherwise. I would say generally, the dispute will be referred by the educator. And again, impartiality, as you have indicated, Chair, we would not like to go and see from which union does this educator belong. Unless if there are disputes which are referred by the union on behalf of their members. That is where, of course, we can say we did not go out and find out which union does this member belong. I think we would like to maintain that impartiality as we move forward. So it might be a bit difficult for those to say, I can really give you the statistics in terms of, say, from which union this is coming from.
Well, I'm not going into the performance agreement again. The laptops were answered. Now let's go to the questions of the Honourable Makubela. He's speaking about, I think, predetermined objectives, the first one. And he spoke to page 38, where there's no reason. And he says, with others too, as you go along. Look at page 38. And I think it's your predetermined objective, yes? Honourable Makubela? Yes, yes. And he says at quite a number of places, you know, you don't have it. Because here you have not achieved, because here you have your, what do you call it, your efficiency. Then you have your target, your actual, and in the performance result, not achieved. Could you perhaps give reasons there? Because the first one here, they say, two, upon application, issue a notice of implementation of a specific CA. Notice issued within 14 days of receipt. The council did not receive any disputes on enforcement of collective agreement. Well, if we just go further, then I'll ask the question, why? Look at the collective agreement. Then the question that should be asked there is why? Because I didn't look at the question properly, there was no dispute. Referred to arbitration. There was no dispute, yeah?
There are even other pages where you will find that.
Yeah.
All I'm saying,
oh,
in most of those areas where you have not achieved, if it were to convene meetings to deal with certain, you do right to say there were no meetings, there was nothing. So that reason is given. It's not left as a blank space. But then you have areas here where there's just no explanation, you know. And I'm saying the principle is that if it's not achieved, even if the reason is obvious, like you did with other blocks, you are able to insert that to say the parties did not attend the meeting or whatever, you know. But there are instances where you say nothing. So I'm saying in future you will need to ensure that we have these reasons. We must not just conclude that that is necessarily the reason.
Yeah, thanks, Chair. Just a point of clarification. I think the point is noted. However, let me tie up with page 38. I think that's where the thing came from. It's not achieved, and then there's an explanation, and the last one is not achieved. There's no explanation. I think in future what we will do, because you see, with the reasons there, we said the General Secretary did not issue any order. So if there is no order issued, there is no need to ensure that the labor inspector monitors anything. So maybe we should have, but it's noted, in future we will put in there so that it becomes clearer to the users of the annual report. Point taken. Thank you.
I would say normally the amendments relating to the Constitution and specifically relating to processes like appointments and promotions would emanate from either a court ruling or a court decision or from the chambers at the provincial level, because that is really where these things are being experienced. So I would say the changing of the constitution would be informed by those two, for now I would say by those two reasons that I've provided, because it's not that easy to change a constitution because of a minor thing, because sometimes, for instance, we're looking, say, at the moment at where there is a decision on appointments and promotions relating to as to whether if the SGB has made a recommendation and to the HOD, and the HOD does not make an appointment, right? Now, if the HOD has not made an appointment, can any of the applicants refer a dispute? Because a dispute will only be referred when the HOD has made the appointment. And once that appointment is made, then whoever applicant would be referring the dispute will have to have a joinder, which will be the person who has been appointed in that position. So we do look at those and see as to whether do they need the amendment of our constitution. We do take those into consideration. However, we have a legal committee that would look through those type of cases that might affect, you know, the constitution, but they take also legal advice. Thank you. I think SGB appointments, remember, in terms of our mandate, we only deal with educators employed in terms of the Employment of Educators Act. So those appointed by the SGBs are not appointed in terms of the Employment of Educators Act. Yes, we do. Yeah, whether they are at the school or at the department, yes, because they are employed in terms of the Employment of Educators Act. Yeah, I think what we're saying is we can only question or oppose if our conduct is being questioned. However, those referrals for review to the Labour Court will have to do with the award. And now the award is they're not questioning the ELRC as the first respondent, but it will be the commissioner or the panelist who issued that award as the second respondent. And what would happen is if the review is successful, then the order will come from the Labour Court that it must be referred back to the ELRC, but under a different commissioner.
To the processes of the the way I understood it, when something is being reviewed, what is the status of the resolution?
Do I understand you correctly? I'm not sure whether I understand correctly. What is the status?
Partly, since it did refer to when there are still negotiations, like on the use one, which has to do with the performance evaluation and so on, that parties can go back, seek mandate, come back, and so on. On that one, I think it's clear, because I think I might not have understood that very well. But the issue was, once it has been resolved by parties, I had thought they are able to just come back and say, we want reviewer. So that's where the status of the resolutions at the chamber, to what, how do they get reviewed if that has to be done, because it can't just be parties not honoring it, you know. Yeah.
I will try and see if I can meet your expectation. I think in that case where they had agreed, and then there might be some disagreements going forward. What would happen is either maybe there are different interpretations, and then if there are different interpretations, they might need an outsider to come up with what, you know, it should be. And if it needs to be revisited, they'll have to revisit it, because that's part of the negotiations. And if all parties are satisfied with the outcome of the advice on the interpretation, yes, that process will have to go back and be negotiated.
We had SAIS in ERC, the department, NIDU, the service delivery unit, because it was felt there's duplication of roles somewhere. And we listened to that. I can't remember what were our recommendations, all of them, but I think, did you speak to each other in the department? You know, when it comes to the clarification of your roles, you want the department to answer. All right. But when it comes to the department, it does first start with the laptops.
Thank you, Chairperson. In respect of the laptops, we recognize there is a problem, and we concur with the honorable members that you know, every teacher should have a laptop by now. So given the problems up until where the ELRC managed it, we then decided to change the whole way in which we look at this laptop initiative. And a solution would be that we as the employer procure a laptop. In other words, we buy the laptop. We pay for the full laptop. And the teacher uses the laptop as a tool of trade. So like every one of us who are in offices who receive laptops or a desktop from the department, the teachers will then receive a laptop. Where we are in the process, we had to first research and see how best we could bring prices down, and that was not an easy process in terms of how we had to understand the market. But we see a way forward around that. And we then had to take the matter to Treasury to get advice from them on how to proceed with the matter, which we've also done, and we understand what we need to do in terms of their requirements. They've now sent us to CETA, which is the IT section of government, and we have to comply with certain specs there. And once we've concluded that, we then need to take a decision how exactly we're going to procure. Most likely, it seems like we'd have to go for a tender process on the matter, and the outcome of that process would then have a single service provider or a multi-service provider in whichever way the procurement, the tender is given, and that would allow for the teachers to get the laptop. So we are in an advanced stage of the process. We are not yet at the stage where we can publicize a tender. It's still at an internal process where we need to go through all the different sections of government to make sure that we comply with the requirements, so that by the time we go for public tender process, we are not guilty of doing anything incorrectly. It's difficult to say the timeline. We would like it to be at least concluded in this financial year, so that in the new financial year, it's operational. It's at the point where teachers are receiving the laptop. A tender, you can expedite the process, but you don't want to do something that's going to be reviewed afterwards. So we're very careful of how we're stepping on it. Given where we are now in October, and we're still meeting with CETA. I think that if we reasonably conclude by the end of this year on all these processes, we would be in a position by the end of the year or the beginning of next year to publicize, and then by the start of the new financial year, I'm sure we would be able to issue out laptops to teachers. Chairperson, it is governed by the constitution of the ELRC in respect to the ELRC. We have a 50-50 relationship there where we have equal power to the union in terms of the ELRC. It's the one arrangement where the power base is equal. So that essentially is how we enter into our roles and our engagement in the ELRC. In respect of the issues that we deal with within the ELRC, we have had discussions, especially on the matter that you raise around NEDU, and then we have whole school evaluation within the department, and then the role and we have the IQNS, which is a collective agreement of the ELRC, and then the role of SACE. So we have ongoing discussions about that. And we have clarified in respect of the role of in particular NEDU, and then what we do in relation to the collective agreement of the IQMS, which is also the same agreement that would be revised when we talk about it, the agreement that is dealing with the performance contract. So it's about performance management. And the answer to our role in respect of those specific issues are that we will always have the responsibility as the employer to ensure that there is adequate monitoring and measuring of performance of our employees. Therefore, that relationship and that role will have to remain with the ELRC, because it is about the conditions of service of employees. When you're measuring their performance, when you're measuring the percentages that they would be getting, those aspects would either lead in labor processes to incapacity if continuously you do not perform at a particular level, or it would lead to a reward, which is the pay progression we give. So either way, it is about employees, and therefore the space and the role that is delegated is the ELRC, and I think we have very clear clarity on that. And we've also said that in respect of that, NEDU will not interfere with that. It's not part of their mandate. So they don't measure performance. They give an external report about what happens in schools, but they do not cover the aspect of measuring performance of educators. Thank you, Chair.
Thanks a lot for that. Yes, Honourable Makubera.
Chair, there's just one issue which we must be assured here as we move towards concluding. It is said that 48% of the targets were not achieved on the year under review, because you only achieved 27% of your targets. And the reason is mainly that the indicators and the targets were not suitably worked out during the strategic planning process. How are we going to be assured that this year, this time around, in this financial year, this will not repeat? If I can draw your attention to page 156, under 12, on the annual report, there has been disclosed that 48% of your targets have not been achieved.
Thank you, Chair. We are aware that 48% is what can be backed up by the approved strategic plans and annual performance plans. However, I think the majority of those non-achievements relates to, as an example, if you look at Eastern Cape, the achievement rate is zero. We know that. You look at KZN, you know, the achievement rate is nearly there, you know, nearly down there. And then what they've also included here is key performance indicators not relating to operational issues. That is where you give KPIs to governance issues. And what they're saying is those we are going to take out, because why should we measure that you have complied with the PFMA by submitting a quarterly report to the executive authority by this date? Those are the things that are included in there, really. And I think I would say the majority of them should not have been there. Now, moving forward, what we have done is, instead of having HR, media, you know, all those things under executive facilitation, we're just going to have, because those are not operational issues. You cannot say you need service delivery from media, from those things. So we are only going to be measuring operational issues where we need to see what the outcome is. And also the framework for managing program performance has now changed, in fact. It's now called strategic plans and annual performance plans. So it's a new framework that has replaced the old one, where we talk about the outcome, the impact, because we're not going to put in the KPIs where you cannot show the impact, because it's going to be very difficult to justify that you have achieved without showing what is the impact. And what is that impact is what has changed for the better. So moving forward, yes, we are aware of that, and we are sure that we would make sure that we don't put the unnecessary things. If you look at dispute resolution, the number that they have there, sometimes you overstretch yourself. Sometimes you look in there, they say they want to see that they can pay invoices within 30 days. Is that a KPI that we need in terms of performance information or performance reporting? It is not. So those are the things that have contributed to a lower achievement rate. Thank you, Chair.
Members, I thought the meeting was going to be concluded at 12:30. We are on 1300 hours. I think when it comes to this meeting, what we received was a bit for Mahala, because I can understand the ELRC now, because I never want to oversight you. I found it very technical. But I appreciate, and I'm sure the others that don't know the Labour Council, the Bargaining Council, appreciate too, you know, that we know what is happening. I think when it comes to the, yes, it's very interesting. I didn't say that one. It came from someone there on the floor. But what I'd like to say, there are certain things that you want, like documents. But I'll go through the minutes, because I was concentrating now, although I just wrote down one or two, concentrating on the questions itself that I wrote down. Once we have it, because it will be in our report, then we'll send it to you to say this is what we need. And I might say that it was good just to have you for one hour meeting, because normally your meeting is shared with another entity. And I think we have to do it more often where we have one entity going through. I think next time it has to be SAIS, or next time it has to be Umalusi. Because meeting SAIS and Umalusi together next week, so that we can also have a long, in-depth discussion and interrogation of the work that you are doing. I would like to thank the honorable members for being so patient. No one fell asleep. No one. No, you don't. But I say no one fell asleep. As usual. I'll say, as usual, no one fell asleep. They found it quite interesting. But I want to say to Grace, close your face a bit, because your expression says it all when an answer is being given. Then I know there's something wrong here. Then I know there's something wrong on this side. Because many times I can't ask you only one question. And I just wanted to do it all along, and that's why I went into the questions itself. Thanks a lot, and even the honorable members for being present, and our staff, and the department itself, and all the assistants to the committee. I'm waiting on ERC to close the meeting.
Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity to express on behalf of my team appreciation of the way it was handled. I think it went beyond our expectations, really. And we do appreciate that by positive interaction. You don't just criticize, you provide alternatives, because I think sometimes it's very frustrating when you get criticized and you don't know what alternative might be required. And I think it's also important that the objective of annual report is for the users, and you are the users, and we should be under your control in terms of how you would need to have this presented to you. And I think it's slowly coming out, because we normally used to think this might be the way they want it. But I think through this time that we spend with you, which I think, Chairperson, I agree with you that you need more time to be with a public entity to understand it, so that you can also offer constructive criticism and also, very important, alternatives on how to better communicate with you. It's not only just a legislative requirement, it's not just a formality. I think it's very important that we need to find each other, we need to understand why we do this. And as always, I say, please keep on monitoring us, because we will do our work. Thank you very much.
Because we start meeting two more entities next week, and we hope those department officials will be present. And then after your entity spoke next week, then you are going to do the vote of thanks too. Thanks a lot. Meeting closed.